Good morning, good afternoon, and good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome back to the Caring Economy with me, Toby Usnick. Today, I have as a guest a friend and also an amazing professional journalist, Jonathan Capehart. He's a Pulitzer Prize-winning associate editor at the Washington Post since 2007. He's also been an opinion writer at the Post. He was a member of the Post editorial board until 2022. He also hosts for the Post a podcast called Capehart and a weekly live show called First Look, which is also streamed on Comcast's Peacock streaming service. Meanwhile, at MSNBC, Capehart is also the anchor of The Sunday Show with Jonathan Capehart, which debuted in February of this year, and then The Sunday Show with Jonathan Capehart, which I've been watching since it aired in 2020. And if that's not enough, he's also at PBS, where he serves as a political analyst on the PBS NewsHour and is featured on the popular Friday segment, Brooks and Capehart. Jonathan Capehart, welcome to the Caring Economy.
Thanks, Toby. It's great to see you.
Jonathan, we always start our show by asking the guest to talk a little bit about his or her journey and how they got where they got. And you've had this incredible career in journalism. You've spanned print, broadcast, digital. Can you tell us a little bit about your upbringing and maybe what led you to a career in journalism?
So I was born and raised in New Jersey, and I've been a news nerd since about the age of 10. My uncle McKinley worked at NBC as an electrician. And one day he said, turn on NBC. They show is doing something on the plaza. I'm going to try to get camera range in Wave. And so I'd not heard of this show before. So, we're watching and waiting for my uncle to somehow appear in the camera. In camera range, I started paying attention to these people on television and what they were doing and what they were, and I thought, oh, this is kind of cool. I was a big tattletale at that time. I always got in trouble for telling other people's business. But here I was watching television, these people telling other people's business in front of lots of people. And so I thought, this looks like kind of a cool job. So I started watching the Today Show at the age of 10. Fast forward to, I think it was about 1984, 85, college interview in a hotel in New York, a block away, called my uncle and said, I'm just up the street. Can I come visit? He said, yes. I get there. He says, you're just in time. I have to do some work in the nightly news office. Oh my God, I'm going to see all these people I've seen on television. It's 9 in the morning, mind you. Get there, he tells me to sit on a sofa. There's no one around. Crickets. This one woman sitting at her desk, reading one of the tabloids, eating a bagel, drinking coffee out of like the Greek diner coffee
Blue
cups,
ones, yeah.
traveling back then. Worked up the courage. I was like 15, I was 17, 18 years old. I worked up the courage to ask her, like, do you work here? Could I ask you questions? Her name, and then she asked me, well, what do you want to be when you grow up? And I was a lunatic. I said, oh, well, I want to be a Moscow reporter for NBC, do that for years, and then I don't know whether I should go to London or go to the White House for a little bit. And then I want to come back, I want to get to New York, be the anchor of the Today Show. I don't even remember the look on her face. I'm sure the age I'm at now, I'd
Ferocious.
probably like, who the hell is this kid? But my uncle comes back, says, okay, it's time to go. And I thanked her. And I remember her name, Anne Skakel-Tarian. Ms. Tarian, thank you very much for answering my questions. And I got up and she opened her desk drawer, she pulled, she said, wait a minute. And she wrote down the name phone number of a woman and she rips it off and says, here, get yourself an internship on the Today Show. And that's how it started.
How amazing. I grew up with the Today Show as well. My mom was a regular watcher, and every morning she'd have us bring a thermos of coffee, turn on the TV because we didn't have remote controls then, and she would watch the Today Show with Barbara Walters. She had us trained well. And I wonder in this day and age if one could even do that today. The security is so pronounced at these news organizations and in New York City, but amazing. But you had the gumption to go there, and that's and it was purely driven from your passion. So good on you. Since then you went to school, you studied journalism. What was your first gig out of school?
I went to Carleton in Minnesota, and there was a journalism program. So I studied political science and history because during my internships at the Today Show, I was told, I think it was Brian Gump who said to me, who was a hero. This was my idol. And he said to me, basically, you can teach anybody how to stand in front of a camera and how to do this, but what you can't teach them at that point is why a story is a story, why they should care. Historical background for everything. So I studied political science and history in college. And pointing that out, I completely forgot what your question was, Toby.
Oh, but you know what? And I should have said at the start, kudos to you. Among your many accolades, you just got your honorary doctorate at your alma mater, Carleton.
Yeah.
So kudos to you, Dr. Capehart. No, I was going to ask, so then you go out at J school and then you go into work?
No, I didn't even get
J school altogether.
No, I didn't go to journalism school. So right after graduation from college, I stayed a year at Carleton to be assistant to the president. And that was just a year gig. And at the end of that year gig, I got a job working with a Carleton alum, Tom Morgan, Carleton class of 49. I'm the class of 89. And he had just been appointed by Mayor Dinkins to be the head of WNYC radio and television.
Got it.
And so I went to his assistant and I did that for 2 years. I was looking for jobs in New York and Washington in television. And he heard about this and asked me like, hey, weren't you going to come to me? Don't you know what I'm doing now? And he said, it's not what you want to do, but it's really close and you get to see a different side. So I did it, but then I really missed television. And so I took 2 weeks off WNYC to work a vacation relief stint at the Today Show. And that's where I made a critical connection, which then led to my being hired as a vacation relief person on the Today Show, which lasted, it was supposed to be a guarantee of 3 months, no health insurance, but with the possibility of being extended. Well, I got extended every week for almost a year, and I left because I got a call from the New York Daily News saying, you know, our publisher is looking for young people who can write for the editorial page. And we got your name from Tom Morgan. Are you interested? And initially, I hung up the phone and said, no, I'm not. I'm having a great time at NBC.
Yeah.
My mom and my partner at the time said, you bananas, call this guy back. See what he wants.
Yeah.
And so that's how I ended up leaving television for print.
Got it.
The mindset that's that it would only be a couple years and I would go back to NBC in a higher position. Mm-hmm. And instead, I became a newspaper man.
Yeah. Well, you made great impressions all along the way if Mr. Morgan was recommending you to the Daily News, because then you go to the Daily News and that's where you won your Pulitzer, right?
Right. Right.
Tell us a little bit about that experience.
Well, it's one of those things where, you know, a lot of newsrooms try to plot and plan things that, you know, will be considered for Pulitzers and mm-hmm. pray that it wins. We took a tour of the Apollo Theater in Harlem after we saw a Daily News business page story about a fight between Mayor Giuliani and Congressman Charlie Rangel, who at the time was the ranking Democrat on House Ways and Means Committee. And Charlie Rangel was, I think at that time, then even the of the congressional delegation, but also one of the four horsemen of Harlem. And so as that, the chair of the Apollo Theater Foundation, well, we decided, well, let's go up to the Apollo Theater and just tour around and see what it's like. And we get there. I was a big watcher of Showtime at the Apollo after Saturday Night Live. So you get this impression that because of this national television show, the theater is like just raking in money. We get there and it was a dump.
Hmm.
Paint peeling from the ceilings, broken seats, tattered carpeting. And you know, there were people from board members there. And one question led to five more questions, which led to five more questions. And so we thought, let's start investigating what's going on here. So for a month, Michael Aronson and I went about trying to understand why the Apollo Theater was not enjoying the same financial success that the refurbished theaters on 42nd Street mm-hmm. were enjoying at that time. And so, you know, I spent a lot of, I went up to Harlem for everything. I went to openings, I went to political speeches. I wanted to understand. And so a month later, we came out with our two-day blockbuster full-page editorials about what was happening at the Apollo. And it was one of the most intense experiences journalistically, overall professionally, and personally, because there I am, this 30-something-year-old kid taking on really powerful people, you know, through the Daily News and, you know, involved in political theater. When I take a step back and think back on it, crazy and naive I was, naive I was at the time. But I thought, you know, this theater is an American jewel.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it should be protected, and these powerful people aren't protecting it.
And you say fast powerful forward, people, sorry, Europe, you mean like real estate developers, politicians, competitors?
Well, mostly talking about, you know, Charlie Rangel and Percy Sutton. Those were the two primary people. And, you know, there's a whole lot of intricate moving parts, but it was an exciting, including, you know, Charlie Rangel trying to get me fired.
Wow.
In the Daily Amazing. News. We laugh about it now.
Yeah, yeah. So then you got your Pulitzer, which must have been just so amazing to get the phone call.
Well, I mean, it was even more intense than that. Our editor was, the Pulitzer board is in two pieces. There's a big sort of preliminary board of like 100 people who cull through the thousands of submissions, and they're whittled down each category to three. So our editor, I think, was on the cartoon, you know, beat. And as I remember, right, he gets on the elevator with this woman, and she introduces herself, he introduces himself. I'm Michael Goodwin, editorial editor of the Daily News. She had a stack of papers there. She does this. I can't talk to you. And so we knew that, I mean, Michael had submitted the Apollo Theater, but also a series of editorials on the City University of New York, and which he thought for sure
would win,
was the Pulitzer worthy thing. And so we come to find out that we are among the finalists, and it's the Apollo Theater. And so you have to understand, there's like a month that's between, I think it's a month between the full board and then, I'm sorry, the advisory board, and then the Pulitzer board comes to meet. We know when they're meeting. We know when Pulitzer Day is. So the meeting is like on a Wednesday, and Pulitzer Day is the following Monday or Tuesday. And it always happens. It leaks out who has won, so newsrooms can prepare. We got the phone call. If they met Wednesday, we got the phone call the next day. And I won't get into the whole story, but there was pandemonium when the phone call came in, but our editor was not there. He was out at lunch. And so we're waiting for him to come back because we know who's called. We know why he's calling. And so now we're like 5-year-olds hopped up on Twinkies and
Christmas Eve, you
know, bags of sugar.
Yeah.
Comes in, we're all standing. We told him who called. He goes into his office, closes the door. We are now all huddled over the back of the old days. You had the phone where you could see all the extensions. We see the light, it's blinking on his hold. Then it comes off blinking, so they're talking. It lasts all of about 15 seconds. And so now we're like, oh God, what does this mean? He opens the door, he sees me, which is a signal for me to yell that it's time for a meeting. We go into the office. I can't take it into his office. I'm laying on his sofa. I'm flat. I am horizontal. I am so freaked out. His face is all red, which is usually a sign that he's mad. The final person comes in, closes the door. He has his hands in his pockets. He turns his back to us. And then he turns around and he whips his hands out of his pockets and he says, "We won." I went from horizontal to vertical, touching the ceiling in a nanosecond. We were screaming. I mean, it was like guttural shrieks. We couldn't believe it.
Awesome.
But I had to hold that news for 5 days.
From your colleagues, yeah.
I mean, colleagues, loved ones. It was one of the most intense experiences, it was fantastic.
Yeah, thank you for sharing that. I think people can relate to similar joys, but not on that scale, perhaps. But that really, in the interest of time, I'm just mindful. So that became a real launch pad for you. That takes us fast forwarding to the Washington Post, MSNBC, PBS. So now, Jonathan, you're the only professional journalist I know who has that trifecta, right? And that you even have permission to work with all these different outlets and organizations, I think is astonishing. Usually I think of a journalist having to choose one outlet only for the most part. But tell us about how did you finesse all that and how do you juggle all that?
Well, you know, truth be told, I am now no longer the only one. My Post colleague, Catherine Rampell, is also doing the same thing. She's a columnist at the Post. She is a contributor at CNN, although she's not an anchor, but she's a contributor at CNN. And she's also a reporter for PBS NewsHour.
Wow. So it's happening.
So, you know, she's doing it as well. But I mean, quite honestly, it was all somewhat accidental. I mean, this industry has changed so much since I got into it. Back in the old days, you're right. You could only, if you were in print, you were in print. And if you went to go to TV, you could never go back to print. Mm-hmm. If you were in TV and you went to print, you might be able to go back to TV, but it was never done. Mm. Today, the media environment is such that if you want a career in this business, in this field, you have to be on multiple platforms. Mm. You just have to. And it's, you know, this is something I stumbled into, but it's something that is now what you have to do in this business. Unfortunately, you know, it's all about brands. Talked about in a pejorative sense. Mm-hmm. Personal sense, I get it, because now the environment is people don't just go to institutions, they go to people inside the institutions who they mm-hmm. trust. And because of social media, first it was the internet that mm-hmm. broke things open. Then social media made it possible for news consumers to hear from directly the reporters, mm-hmm. but also in touch with them directly. So now there's a personal relationship between the reporters and the audience. And so now it's just imperative that we be on all of these platforms and have social platforms, but also professional platforms, so that the things that we write have let on television or in a podcast or in some other way to broaden the reach, mm-hmm. broaden the reach of the audience. And because my work at the Washington Post informs what I will say on PBS News, informs what I'll do on my show, which informs what I'll write about, all of jobs reinforce the other.
Yeah.
It's a lot. It's a lot of work. But there's not a lot of duplicate. It's work that reinforces other things.
Yeah, because you're on a mission. You have your purpose. Ladies and gentlemen, today on The Caring Economy, we have the celebrated journalist, Jonathan Capehart. Jonathan, I like that idea. I often talk to people in career coaching about kneading dough. And if you figure out your purpose, your mission, all of it's additive, right? There's no really extraneous stuff. And it sounds like that's part of your secret to success with your journalism. As you say, all these different outlets feed into the same kind of storytelling or reporting that you're doing. But still, it's a lot. How do you find work-life balance if you do it all?
Well, I mean, as I've learned growing older, it's a constant struggle. Anyone who tells you they've got it figured out isn't really telling the truth. Yeah. And so I just come to terms with the fact that I have to work 7 days a week and that I have to squeeze out moments, personal joy and relaxation. You know, wherever I can find it, could be watching an episode of Bridgerton. It could be going for a 6-mile walk in Washington. But once you embrace the fact that, okay, this is what my love is, then you just start to readjust and figure out ways to bring, if not balance, some rational way of making it all.
Yeah. Well, I've loved on, I follow you on social media, and I always loved the little moments you have with your mom. I know how much you love her. You travel with her. And I'm glad that she's also part of that work-life balance. I wonder, you've covered the whole intersection of race, gender, sexuality, and American politics. And I wonder what some of the challenges are, what some of the opportunities are that you faced as Black, gay journalist. Are there any myths to bust or shout outs to give to either mentors or organizations that are really leading the way?
Well, I have to say, you know, the naivete that I talked about earlier, when you're that naive, you don't see the obstacles. You don't see, you just plow right through. What do you mean? Well, of course I can do this. And I'm going to do it. And I'm doing it. And I'm damn good. And so you just have to deal with it. You know, I'm sure there have been moments in my career because of my race or because of my sexual orientation, opportunities didn't come my way. Mm-hmm. And I could, you know, spend a lifetime trying to understand what those are. But if I were to do that, I would appreciate the opportunities that I'm taking advantage of now and the mm-hmm. life that I have now. I won an award, a James Baldwin Legacy Award. Mm-hmm. And from the National Black Justice Coalition, they had Eugene Daniels, who is an out Black, a gender nonconforming reporter, White House reporter for Politico. They had him present the award to me. They didn't tell me that he was the one. And he talked about how, you know, seeing me on television when he was coming up showed him that it was possible for him to his full, true, authentic self. And, you know, that just moved me beyond words.
I mean, he was your Brian Bumble.
Like, oh, don't say that. You're going to make me cry. you know, here I am. I'm an out gay man, Black, doing my thing. But Eugene takes the next level. Eugene, when he shows, Eugene is like 6'3". And has big afro, but he comes to the set with his nails out and, you know, and is just himself. And it is wonderful. Could you imagine what news consumers would lose out, what Politico would lose out if they saw him and decided he shouldn't be a reporter for them, or he shouldn't be on television. And so I think as slow progress is being made.
Yeah. Well, let me build on that, because really something that keeps me up at night and keeps my family divided is the polarization in this country. And I wonder what you're, as we go into this election year, I wonder what you think about that polarization, particularly in politics and media, and how do we bridge this nation back together in your own sort of experience or thoughts?
Yeah, I think the polarization has always been there. It's always been there. What's different now is that, you know, on election, well, through that campaign, a 2016 campaign, basically since June 16th, 2015, when Trump came down that escalator, for the first time in our history, we had someone who took a sledgehammer to norms, to political norms, which was, okay, fine. Politicians do that all the time during campaigns, but he went an extra step. When he won election, what that meant was for the first time, we had a chief executive who used the moral authority of the Oval Office of the presidency to give legitimacy to hate. Mm-hmm. And we don't like to think in this country that the president has that power or that much sway, but he does. Mm-hmm. And it trickles down and you see how it plays itself out, because people can turn it around and say, President of the United States can say that, so can I. If the President of the United States is not going to stand up for the right of the free press, he's going to attack the press and say that they're the enemy of the people, well, so can I. And we see the impact of that overseas. If the President of the United States is going to be the moral bulwark for democracy writ large, that gives permission to leaders around the world to say, the United States, the president is attacking the press, I'm going to do the same thing. And so now we see democracies that have leaders who are very European and attacking the press and attacking freedoms and liberties that we thought were guaranteed, we thought were permanent, and they're not. And so I think the one thing that needs to happen is that leaders, particularly in the Republican Party, need to standing up and saying, this is wrong, this is not who we are, this is what we need to turn things around. And unfortunately, it's going to take the next presidential election to determine whether we are going to start down that road as opposed to the very dangerous road we would go down if, say, he won re-election.
But you're an insider in Washington at this point. I wonder, I'm sure you have conversations with Republicans in private who agree with you. How do you get them to help sway that party in that direction of a more centrist?
They can't. I mean, raw politics. If they come out against Trump or, you know, take a line that is not, they will get a primary challenge from the right. The Republican Party is so far to the right now. I mean, here's the challenges are coming from the edge of the flat. Yes. I mean, that's how far they've gone to the right. So they face primary challenges. Also, what's not talked about a lot is, and just sort of say, no one has told me this directly, but I hear it indirectly, the threats that people for not hewing, loyal or, sufficiently supportive of Donald Trump. And so that, that flies the mind. Yeah. And so that's why I say it, in order for us to get on this, he's got to be defeated at the ballot box.
And then hopefully, justice will work slowly but surely. And we have to just keep on keeping on, I guess. Jonathan, I'm mindful of time. I want to ask you one last question, which is your pearls of wisdom that you've gleaned through the year. You've got this incredibly mission-driven life, purpose-driven life, in my observation. And I admire that. I respect that. I try to do the same with this podcast and my own work. I wonder what messages you might share or lessons learned through the years for either a young person starting out or maybe even someone who's a little bit more disenchanted with the world we're in now.
Wow. Well, I look at things like this. There have been when you have a time where you have to decide, you're going to stand with someone who's going through something, or you're going to take a stand for yourself and decide, you're not going to allow something to happen. The one thing that anyone needs to know is, be true who you are, your values, or your understanding of things. And I say that, and it sounds so simple. There are way too many people out there who don't know who they are. Mm-hmm. And as a result, they end up doing things that down the road will be detrimental to themselves or their organization or their community. Sometimes it's hard to stand with someone who is controversial or doing or saying things or has gotten into trouble. But, the person was good to you. And I'm thinking of a specific situation where I stood by a colleague who was in trouble. Mm-hmm. A colleague had always been to me, and what was alleged to have been written was the person I knew. And a lot of people told me, do it. Don't stand by that person. But I did. Mm-hmm. Because that person, loyalty means a lot in the benevolent sense. Mm-hmm. And I was to do that because I know who I am. Mm-hmm. And if you don't know who you are at this very moment listening to this, start interrogating yourself and yep. start interrogating yourself about who you are and then how are you manifesting that. And once you do that, then everything gets easier.
I'm with you on that. I mean, that's the whole purpose of the caring economy. So I want to thank you, Jonathan Capehart, celebrated journalist and friend, and now Dr. Capehart as well. Thank you for joining us on the caring economy today.
Thanks, Toby.
And be sure to get some rest. It's going to be one hell of an election cycle.
Telling me.